Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Whatever happens today, take it on with a fresh cup of True Brew coffee. Now only $1 with True Rewards. True North Store's True Brew coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. As a free True Rewards member, pick the size that is perfect for you and pay only $1. Don't have the True Rewards mobile app? Find it in the Apple or Google Play Store to download and save instantly. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I'm caught up in the game. My attention is on every play and every whistle. But what I'm missing is a signal coming from my kidneys. That signal isn't like a ref's whistle. It's more of a silent SOS, which could be warning me of an increased risk for events like heart attack or stroke. And a way I can catch that signal? A simple urine test called UACR. If you have type 2 diabetes or high blood pressure, talk to your doctor about the UACR test. Detect the SOS. Visit detectthesos.com to learn more.
Welcome to Amplify, a telephone talk show that looks at life from a religious perspective. I'm Monsignor Ron Langman, hoping that you have felt the warmth of God's love in your life this day, but especially the joy you feel when you share God's love with others. As we do each week, I'd like to begin our program with a story that is based on faith, but formed with imagination. Jesus was always pleased when his followers were rested and well-fed, because he knew that their minds would be open and at ease, and then he could truly teach them. It was John who asked him, "Master, how should I live my life?" The others looked at one another and began to laugh, but John did not pay any attention to them and asked again, "Master, how should we, your followers, live our lives?" Peter said, "And now he includes us." And the men laughed again. With a slight smile on his face, Jesus said, "Peter, John asked a good and clean question." "Clean? Clean?" Judas questioned. "Yes," Jesus answered, "and clean. To live a good life, one must have a clean heart and a clean mind. Many times one must think of another before he thinks about himself." Judas responded, "So that person falls and he does not get dirty?" Jesus shook his head and replied, "Judas, Judas, why do you mock me?" Judas answered, "At our age, Master, we should know how to live. Is this not true?" Jesus responded, "My friends, you are but children. Age, wealth, or education makes no difference. Our Father wishes us to live a simple life, a life of prayer, a life of hard work, a life in which we learn much from a listening ear, because we can learn so much from others, and also from listening to our heart and mind. In time, I must leave you." The men just looked at one another, wondering what he meant. But Jesus continued, "My words will always be with you. Remember how I have lived simply, a life devoted to teaching you the Father's will." Then tears began to stream down Jesus' cheeks, and he said nothing more. The disciples also remained silent, until finally Jesus said, "My friends, I weep not for myself, and not really for you, but for the generations to come. Will the generations to come remember the words I have spoken, and the words you will instill in others? Will one follow the other?" Jesus looked up to the heavens, and then down to the earth, to the fire that warmed them, and said, "O Heavenly Father, I pray that our love for you will burn in the hearts of men like this flame that warms us tonight. Let it burn and grow. Let its light cast out the darkness in man's mind, and let it warm their hearts so that they may continue to speak about you and praise you. Let it continue unceasingly like the waters that wash upon the shore." A Story of Faith and Imagination. Our guest this evening writes in the introduction to her book titled Life and Love, Opening Your Heart to God's Design. Today we are living in a time and in a culture that Pope St. John Paul II coined a culture of death. And we've been living it for a long time, more than 100 years. Someone once told me that the culture of death means that someone has to die to solve a problem. To be sure, we just need to look around to see that there is death everywhere. Violence, war, capital punishment, abortion, euthanasia, suicide, you name it. It's everywhere. At first glance, it may not be apparent that the culture of death and all that it entails is related to the use of contraception. However, the connection is present. Contraception introduced the idea that life is disposable, that we, in fact, have the power to reject it. Violence, war, capital punishment, etc., are all a root manifestation of rejecting life. Sadly, we are all product of this culture of death in one way or another. According to John Paul II, it is culture, not politics or economics, that drives history. His biographer, George Weigel, explains St. John Paul's thought, quote, "Culture was, is, and always will be the most dynamic force in history, allowing us to resist tyranny and inspiring us to build and sustain free societies." Moreover, John Paul II understood that at the center of culture is cult, or religion, what people believe, cherish, and worship, what people are willing to stake their lives and their children's lives on. It is not surprising, then, that John Paul II strongly believed that the Church is in the position to shape the culture by helping to change the way people think and act. In order to affect the kind of change that John Paul envisioned, however, we must be able to see what the Church sees, to think with the mind of the Church. This means, quote, "When we look out upon the universe, we see the same universe that the Church sees," close quote. We normally look at things in the moment, in relationship to ourselves. In contrast, the Church always sees things in totality, in relationship to the whole, according to the plan of God. Our guest this evening is Terry Polakovich, who lives in Denver, Colorado, with her husband, Mike. They have two adult children. Terry is one of the co-founding members of Endowing on the Nature and Dignity of Women, and served as president of that organization from 2004 to 2015. She worked in nonprofit leadership for more than 30 years and is now retired. In 2019, she received the Pro Ecclesiae and Pontifice Cross Award. That means for the Church and the Pontiff from Pope Benedict XVI. In 2011, Terry was recognized as an outstanding Catholic leader by the Catholic Leadership Institute, and she's written this book specifically to highlight the 50th anniversary of the document Humanae Vitae about contraceptive. Terry Polakovich, welcome to Amplify.
Thank you, Father. This is a real honor for me. I really appreciate you asking me.
You are sure welcome. What is it that you hope to accomplish through this book?
Well, what I hope to accomplish through this book is a storyline, I guess would be the best way to put it, is that the church has been and always will be our mother and teacher. And the change in the culture that we're experiencing today did not obviously start today or even in the 1960s when Pope Paul VI released Humanae Vitae. It started back, I mean, it probably started even before this, but this is when I started, it's in 1880. And I took a look. I was mainly looking at Humanae Vitae, but I was also looking at why was there such an eruption? Why was there so much hatred and up to the point of a complete split in the church that we're still suffering from? What was it about this document? So really, that was my thought going into it. And so what I wanted to learn is I wanted to learn, like, what came before it. It didn't just erupt. I mean, it didn't just, he didn't just write this document out of the blue. Something had to have preceded it, and obviously a lot followed it. And so I guess I was trying to figure out the underpinnings of what happened in 1968 when Humanae Vitae was released. And so that took me on a very interesting journey, quite frankly. I went back to 1880, as I said, and I studied Pope Leo XIII. He was the pope at that time, and he wrote an encyclical called Arcanum, and it's on Christian marriage. And even at that time, he was worried, and he was... One thing, I just want to do a little time out here. Every single pope in this book, I saw them as taking care of their flock. I mean, just taking on that responsibility to lead the flock. So I saw this first in Pope Leo XIII and how he was trying to gather his church together, quite frankly. They were going through the Industrial Revolution, which had split families, and that it caused a lot of, you know, pain in families and divorce and all kinds of things. But even more than that, Marxism and socialism was creeping into society, and it was finding its way into the minds and hearts of the people of the time, wanting just to have, you know, with the promise of, you know, a job and, or, you know, an income, and we'll all be the same, and, you know, we're against the church, the state will take care of all of us, that kind of thing. You can see that that would have been a very appealing message at that period in time. So I started with him, and does that answer your question?
That's fine. We're going to talk about each of these eight documents. And we can, and as we get into them, we'll describe a little bit why you selected that one. You selected them basically. You said you write because they articulate the church's teaching that are most significant for the survival of a civilization in which the human person is fully valued, empowered, and able to flourish in accordance with the plan of God. Is that
yes,
not true?
Exactly.
Right. And so you point out that the truth can set you free, and we hear that phrase spoken often, but you indicate that it can also make you squirm. Why is that? It can set you free, but make you squirm at the same time. Why is that?
Well, I mean, the truth can set you free when you, for instance, when you're following God's will and you're willing to have light shined upon your own failings and your own life, and so that you'll be free of the sin of your life, of the brokenness, that type of thing. But it also can make you squirm in the sense that many people, and I would say maybe most, are not willing. They may long for the truth, but they're not willing to go there. I think that's, we all long for the truth, so that's a definite fact. But going to the truth and following the truth is not always easy. And so many, many people would prefer just to, you know, to go a different way. But when they are presented with the truth, they have no defense mechanism other than to squirm. I mean, they know it's true.
Yes, we know it's true, but we don't always want to live that way.
Right.
What do you mean when you say that we live in a fallen world?
Oh, my gosh. We live in such a fallen world. And I don't know if people in every generation talk like this, and maybe so, but I just feel that our world right now is so broken. I mean, so it's just everywhere. People, I have a group of women that I lead. I've been leading for years. First started out as an Endow study, and then this year we went through this book. And in the group, which are all beautiful Catholic women, I mean, one of the women's children was struggling with his sexuality. Another, same, struggling with his sexuality. That one was on the verge of divorce. One was living with, a girl. This type of thing. I mean, it's just, even among our small circle, that's why I just noted it. Among our small circle, there was so much brokenness. If you go outside that circle, it exaggerates itself even more.
Yes.
I mean, you can't, the front page of the paper, I mean, everything.
The book was fascinating to me, from the very start in terms of what you're trying to accomplish, because you talk about Humanae Vitae of Human Life being published in 1968. I was ordained in 1966.
And
So I was right in the midst of all of that as a young priest ordained 2 years, and it was quite a struggle that was going on, not just because of that, but because the Second Vatican Council had just ended, too. We were the first class to be ordained after the Second Vatican Council documents were promulgated.
Oh, my gosh.
Why has the Church showed, and certainly we'll see this throughout from 1880 to the last choice is The Joy of Love by Pope Francis in 2016. Why has the Church showed a fascinating and continued urgency in its teaching on human life and human love, which is really almost the title of your book?
Yes, because it is an urgent message. I mean, it's nothing to be taken lightly. We are on the verge of destruction. I mean, I really don't mean that anymore lightly. I don't mean that lightly. I mean, the Church, I feel, at this point is just shouting to the culture. And, just because, I mean, we've gotten so far off track in our own morals and values and virtue, in our families and our belief system, the material, materialism, I think Pope Francis even spoke about that today, even to the point of we've lost what it means to love. We really don't know today what it means to love, what it means to sacrifice, what love requires so much sacrifice, and who's willing to do that sacrifice, that type of thing. I feel that it's very urgent, Father. I really do. I'm sure you must feel that way, too.
Sure. Where does that distortion come from? Is it from the culture in which we live?
I think it is from the culture in which we live. But another thing I feel is, on a personal level, I wish the Church would have spoken out louder than she did at that point in time, like during when you were ordained a priest and that type of thing. Because today, I think that's a confusing thing. I really, now that you ask that question, I just think it's confusing from people today because there's no difference in many ways in the Church of today and in the Church in the culture of today.
Okay. And one thing we're going to find out as we touch, hopefully we can touch upon all these 8 documents before the end of the night. Do all the teaching documents deal in some way with the sanctity of life?
Yes, every one of them.
And that says something about the importance of love too, doesn't it?
Right, right. That life is the most important thing.
The times, they are changing. You touched already on the first document on Christian marriage by Pope Leo in 1880. tell us a little bit about the vision that haunted him for the rest of his life that led to the composition of the prayer to Saint Michael the Archangel that in my parish we say after every Mass, and in the fact that he saw the future of the Church.
He did. It happened after he was he had finished saying Mass, as I recall, and he went around and he fell prostrate on the floor, and people were there and they saw it happen. And during this time, God allowed him to see a vision of God speaking with the devil. And in essence, the devil is making a wanting to make a bargain with God, saying, you know, give me your church for 100 years. You know, just give it to me for 100 years. And our Lord, says, he says, yes, you can have it for 100 years, basically. And what came from that is that we are in the 100 years of Satan's rule. I believe that. And I think Satan, of course, wants to destroy life and wants to destroy families. You know, life comes through families. And so this has really been a time of war on the family. And I make mention of that in the 8th chapter with Pope Francis, is that he is living that vision that Pope Leo XIII had. I want to say also, after he had that vision, that's when Pope Leo XIII wrote the prayer of Saint Michael the Archangel,
yes, right,
that you say you pray after Mass every day.
And we're going to take our first break real soon, but I was really surprised. I had no idea he had written 85 encyclicals in 26 years, and that you point out how, for better or worse, the Industrial Revolution had a profound impact on the community, and that Pope Leo introduced this encyclical by asking, what did God intend? And there are many consequences when we don't follow God's plans. We're going to take this break, and then we will be right back. Welcome back to Amplify, where our guest this evening is Terry Polakovic. We're talking about her book, Life and Love, Opening Your Heart to God's Design. Terry, let's move to the second teaching document, Costi Canubi, of Chaste Wedlock. And you point out that when Leo the 11th wrote this,
It's Pope Pius the 11th.
Pope Pius the 11th. Okay, what did I say?
Leo.
Okay, no, we had Leo the 13th earlier. Okay, that he was offering a sobering reminder to all of us that it is precisely because of our human tendency to rationalize our private choices that Christ established a teaching church. That it is the church and not private judgment that has been entrusted with revelation regarding faith and morals. What is it that he was trying to teach us about what is marriage?
Well, marriage, what the Pope was trying to teach us? Is that what you're asking me?
Yes.
First of all, he was trying to teach us that it's a covenant with God. I mean, first of all, it is there's three people in a marriage, a husband and wife and our Lord, that it is a bond that cannot be broken, it's the marriage should always be open to life and bringing forth children and educating children. And it is the foundation of society. It is the very foundation of society.
And as you point out in your book, the encyclical begins by reminding us that marriage is, of its very nature, a divine institution, that God instituted marriage, but no one is obliged to marry. However, once a couple does not enter matrimony, they do it on God's terms, not on their own. And so, contrary to popular opinion, the, quote, main union of marriage is not the physical, it is rather the spiritual union of the hearts and minds of the married people. How do you suggest that we get people back to the point where they might truly believe that?
That's a very good question. Well, our age is so over-sexualized that it is going to be a very difficult path back. And many people say they'll take years and years. The way that I think that the best way for us to do that in our culture today is to live it. I mean, people, when I wrote this chapter, I was actually kind of thinking of my own marriage. We are older. I mean, we're in mm-hmm. our 60s. We've been married for over 35 years. And I can see our whole marriage has been transformed. And we're much more of a spiritual marriage today than we were when we got married. And it's so much more rich. And you clearly have the idea that you're at this stage of life, you really need to try to get your partner to heaven. And you both need to be looking to heaven. But as far as how can we teach young children, I mean, there's so many different programs and that type of thing out there to teach children, Catholic and non-Catholic, basically. But I think it's only by living it that children and young people will be able to really get an idea of what it looks like.
Let me read a couple of the things that you have written within this chapter. You write that if a marriage is based on passion alone, the risk for failure is great. As we can well appreciate, our passions burn out and our physical bodies change as the years go by. Spiritual qualities are more enduring than the physical, and it is upon these spiritual qualities that an enduring union must be founded. Christian marriage is a partnership between a husband and wife with God as the third partner. It should be rooted in unselfish love, which is exactly how God loves us. Married couples are, in fact, co-creators of the universe. Together with God, they keep the human race in existence. Failing in marriage, therefore, means failing God, our partner. Those are very important words, aren't they?
Yes, yes. And I think, you know, we need to remember that. I mean, it's not just the two of us. I mean, if something would happen, you know, between my husband and I, first of all, it would not, you know, be the two of us for any number of reasons, our children and our community and God, I mean, you know, that type of thing. But to think really of God as our partner, and it's important to remember that he's our partner, particularly when times are tough, that we're not in this by ourselves, that he is our partner for good or for bad. And so if we fail each other, we also fail him. I mean, and more or less we're saying we don't trust you. We don't trust that you're in this with us. If we go ahead and make our own decisions to call this off or do something like that, you know, are no longer a partner with us.
What was Pope Pius XI already saying about threats to marriage back in 1930?
Well, what he was saying, he spoke out after a conference, which is called the Lambeth Conference. It was in the Anglican Church. And they'd had that conference every 10 years. And up until that point, the Anglican Church and every other Protestant church had always been against artificial contraception. And at that particular conference, they changed, in particular the Anglican Church changed, and they cracked the door open. That's exactly what they did. They just cracked the door open, and they said, well, in some circumstances, you know, very rare. I mean, all the things that we still hear today, I mean, we hear that about abortion, you know, just a rare, rare circumstance. Well, after that happened with the Anglican Church, all the other Protestant denominations fell. And it was really the Catholic Church left standing. And so when I was writing this, I had the image of Pope Pius XI almost standing on a mountain, you know, screaming, this is wrong. It is not the truth. The Catholic Church will maintain the truth. And then it was on his shoulders to carry it forward. It was not like he had backing at other denominations or anything like that. It was the Catholic Church that would carry the truth forward.
Let's move on then to Humanae Vitae, written by Pope Paul VI in 1968, that we've referred to a number of times now. And you indicate, you write, that we need to look at him through the lens of the Second Vatican Council, which he brought to a close and then had to deal with the conflict that arose from it in what was intended to be a pastoral council. So I lived through that, too. And he led the church, you write, during the upheaval of the 1960s and the uncertainty of the 1970s, a time when the whole world was in moral chaos. Tell us a little bit more about that time for which he was writing.
He issued the document in 1968, and I've read somewhere that was someone, I think it's Paul Johnson, a historian, wrote that that's the year that America tried to commit suicide. And I write in here, you know, the unprecedented social changes globally and at home, the Cold War, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, the Cuban Missile Crisis, the feminist movement, the civil rights movement, the birth control, all affected the human psyche. And that was what was happening when he wrote this document. It was a turbulent time. That's why I even brought up the question earlier. Does every age and time think that theirs is the worst age and time, you know, because, you know, this is what's happening in 1968. And I remember that quite, you know, vividly, quite frankly. And it was a crazy time. So that's what the world that he was writing to. And I'm sure that's exactly why it just, you know, blew up in his face.
And There was so much going on, yes, and I remember all of those things, and you indicate that Pope John's greatest concern, as you refer to John the 23rd and the Ecumenical Council, was that the sacred deposit of Christian doctrine be guarded and taught more effectively. And it was important to him that the church's doctrine be presented in a positive way. Was then Pope Paul VI trying to do that?
There's debates about that. I think he was very sincerely trying to do that, and he laid out all the different things that would happen if we opened the faith to the use of contraception. He just laid it out perfectly. Did he lay it out in a way that was attractive and, you know, that type of thing? Was it presented in a positive way? I mean, I think there's a little bit of debate on that. I think John Paul II just breathe life into the whole Humanae Vitae with his theology of the body. And then it was very attractive, very positive. But it was a different time. I mean, Pope Paul VI was a different man. He was living in a different time. He had a different personality. He had agonized over this decision, agonized for over 2 years. And so the world was waiting, and he knew they were waiting to attack him. I mean, it was obvious in everything in the culture and the magazines and articles and this and that. They were waiting. The world, quote, was waiting to attack him. So I don't consider Humanae Vitae to be necessarily a joyful document. It's a very considered document. It's almost painful. You can feel his pain in writing it as you read it. But it's very short, and it's very accurate. It just puts out the facts.
It's interesting to me that questions were already being raised about what does the church have to offer, because that same question is asked by younger generations and others also, even this very day, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I am actually of a mind that the church has a lot to offer, and I this is me. I don't feel that we need to be bending so much to make it attractive, or you know, have to compete with TV or whatever. You know,
yes.
I mean, the church. This is not the church. And I think the more we try to do that with younger people, particularly this group, the millennials, I think we're doing them a disservice. In fact, it shows, because many of the millennials are heading back to the Latin Mass.
Yes. Yes.
You know,
that's curious.
Been shown, just increasing.
Tell us about the report that that Pope Paul had asked a group to look at and make recommendations to him, and it ended up causing him more grief than he thought.
Yes. There was a report. It was called a Minority Report. What happened was, during the Second Vatican Council, John the 23rd, first of all, a lot of people thought that the whole birth control issue would be part of the Second Vatican Council. And John the 23rd saw right away that that would be trouble and cause so much consternation and that type of thing, and he didn't want that for the Second Vatican Council. So he pulled it out of the agenda, if you will, and he gave it to a group, I think it was 7 or 8 people, to study. And what they were studying is whether contraception, the birth control pill, was in fact contraception, since it was different from other forms of contraception that always took place around the sexual act. You could take the birth control pill in the morning, and it, you know, would have nothing to do with that evening, what you did in your room that evening. And so that was what he asked them to study. But it was, in a sense, hijacked, because there was an agenda that people wanted the church to accept contraception. So when Pope Paul VI was elected, he expanded that committee. He wanted more information. He wanted doctors and lawyers and priests and teachers, and he just really wanted to be really well-informed. And again, what happened is the majority of that committee turned against him. It turned against his original question, which is the birth control pill a contraceptive?
Go ahead.
Well, and then the majority and the minority, each gave the Pope a report. It's called the Majority Report and the Minority Report. And the Pope prayed about this for, like I was saying earlier, over 2 years. But somewhere in there, people got anxious, and you know, probably the people on the committee, and the Majority Report leaked that report to the world and to the press. And so that got people more enthused, you know, at the possibility that this might happen, that the church might change the teaching and that type of thing. And that was all wrong. That was completely wrong. At that point, it was really in the hands of the Pope, and it was his decision to make. They had no right to go around him.
And this was his final encyclical, wasn't it?
Yes, it's the last encyclical that he ever wrote. I think it's 10 years. He was still a pope for 10 more years, but he never wrote another encyclical.
As you reflect and break down Humanae Vitae, you indicate that part two discusses some of the more demanding issues of our day that Pope Paul VI addressed: what it means to be human, marital love, responsible parenthood, the nature and purpose of the marital act, and the two inseparable aspects, union and procreation, and the illicit and licit means of regulating births. And you point out he also issued a prophetic warning regarding the consequences of widespread contraception. What was that prophetic warning?
Well, he really, spoke about the, he said he... that marital infidelity would, result in a lowering of morality, that it would result in marital infidelity, quite frankly, and that it would become widespread in society, that there would be a loss of respect for women, that it would be misused by public authorities, and a disregard of to the limits of man and woman over their own body. That, leading to the point where we are today is that you can control your body, it's your body. And so he foresaw all of that.
And in the summary of it, you write that Paul VI had been called a weak and indecisive pope, but no one who lacked true courage could have issued the powerful statements he did. It would have done so under the circumstances he faced. Despite the obstacles he had to encounter along the way, the pope persevered and never gave up hope, even when he had more than enough reasons to be sad and despondent. Pope VI was simply a man of faith, and you also indicate in this chapter that he was a missionary and a mediator. So you have good things to say about him in the end, even though he agonized over one of the great decisions in the church.
Yes, I actually, when I finished this chapter, I had so much respect for him. I mean, so much respect for him and the person he was. I think he's always portrayed, negatively, and weak, and that type of thing. And he wasn't that type of person at all. As I said in the book, he was a mediator. And I also think I put in this chapter that he could calm a room down just by walking in the room. Mm. I mean, he engendered that much respect from people. So I think he hasn't been portrayed correctly. What people know about him is that how much he agonized over this decision. But quite frankly, a lot of it, his agonizing was probably in anticipation of everything that was going to come, because there, as we have said, and as you know better than I, the church split, so many lost yes. vocations, so many, that would cause him great agony.
And this was the third, then, if you point out, in the trilogy of three major encyclicals on marriage and the family life, used to restate and strengthen the church's teaching. And then you write, all of these documents were written, and these are the three that we've talked about so far, all of these documents were written to counter a perceived threat to marriage. Quote, in each of these encyclicals, the church not only restates its perennial teaching on marriage and family, but also develops aspects of the theology of marriage that had not been fully articulated before. And as we continue on, we're going to find out that teaching is as important today as it was back in 1880, isn't it?
Right. I mean, what I mean by that, in 1880, Pope Leo XIII couldn't have even imagined what Pope Francis is dealing with. And quite frankly, one of the things that Pope Paul VI does not really get into is the homosexuality that would come, and the homosexual marriages and all that type of thing. I mean, he was very prophetic, but he didn't even see that. So, as culture has evolved, new things crop up. I mean, they're cropping up all the time. There are all these different genders. I mean, who could have imagined that when Pope Leo XIII was the pope?
And I should point out, at the end of each chapter, you have reflection questions for people by way of discussion. And from one of them in this particular chapter is, from the 1960s through until today, Catholics, clerical, religious, and lay have felt free to debate openly the teachings of the church. For example, with the release of every new papal document, there are people waiting in the wings to weigh in on whether they agree or disagree, and it goes on from there. And you ask, does this help or hurt the church? What's your own view? We only have 30 seconds till our break.
I think it hurts the church.
By By the divisions it creates, you mean?
Yes.
And it hurts then the teaching of the church, the teaching authority of the church also on so many issues then. We're talking this evening with Terry Polakovic. We're talking about her book, Life and Love, Opening Your Heart to God's Design. And when we come back after the break, we're going to talk about five others, if we have time, of those particular documents. Welcome back to the second hour of Amplify, where our guest is Terry Polakovic. She's reading a book titled Life and Love, Opening Your Heart to God's Design. She has selected eight documents of church teaching that she believes articulate the church teachings of the church that are most significant for the survival of a civilization in which the human person is fully valued, empowered, and able to flourish in accordance with the plan of God. And we've covered three of those eight so far. One was on Christian marriage by Pope Leo XIII, second of chaste wedlock by Pope Pius XI, and also on human life by Pope Paul VI. Left for us to talk about are three by John Paul II, one by Pope Benedict, and one by Pope Francis. The fact that there are three, Terry, by Pope John Paul II, St. Pope John Paul II, I should say, must mean something.
Well, it does mean something. First of all, it means that he was Pope a very long time. But it also means that his whole entire pontificate was, the family was the center of his entire pontificate. The role of the family, role of the Christian family in the world, which is our next document, Familiaris Consortio. He emphasized the family so much in so many different ways.
And when we talk about what things were like at that particular time, in 1980, he called the first Synod of Bishops, and it had the title, The Role of the Christian Family in the Modern World. And he believed that the family is placed at the center of the great struggle between good and evil, between life and death, between love and all that is opposed to love. And the bishops from developing countries, you write, raise many issues dealing with such matters as family survival under difficult political and economic circumstances, the role of the state in determining family size, the survival of the Christian family, where Christians were a minority population, and for industrialized countries, the concerns were more about internal family issues such as contraception and the challenges of maintaining intimacy in marriage, the church's response to divorce, the need for family spirituality, and the roles of women and men in the family. Can we assess in any way how much these encyclicals have been accepted by people? It doesn't seem perhaps that there's been much that has changed, but certainly it could be a lot worse at least.
I'm sorry, your question could be a lot worse today?
We're hoping that things get better after the church speaks out.
That
doesn't always happen, at least it's
no,
not, we can't always
mystery.
See that.
Yeah, that's the mystery of John Paul II's pontificate, is that he couldn't have possibly done any more. There was no way he could have done any more to protect the family, and to the point of taking on the suffering, accepting the suffering that came his way, offering it up for the family. I mean, opening the John Paul II Pontificate or John Paul II Institute, just writing this encyclical. Preaching about it. He did everything he possibly could to highlight the family.
And in response to my question, part of you answer yourself in this particular chapter when you write, the family crisis that we are currently experiencing is not due to the lack of church teaching regarding marriage, divorce, homosexuality, and the like. No, the teaching is there for anyone who is willing to listen. It is a, quote, crisis of confidence and a crisis of faith, close quote. And then you continue writing, there is a lack of confidence in presenting the church's teaching on marriage and family because many people, including many bishops and pastors, think the teaching is too demanding. That seems to be hard to say, including bishops and pastors.
Oh, yes. I mean, I feel very strongly about that. I feel, again, the whole thing got off track because of the number of bishops and pastors and, you know, just priests who would not accept the teaching of Pope John Paul or Pope Paul VI. And I still feel today, I mean, I wonder how many people even heard a homily on Humanae Vitae, and yet when it was last week or the week before, I think it was July 25th, if they even heard a homily that Sunday or that particular day of the week on this document, this monumental document has changed the church so much. Did anyone speak out about it? I mean, actually, our priest spoke. I was a deacon, and he spoke. But I wonder how many. You never hear it from the altar. You really do. You never hear it from the altar. I feel quite honest in this criticism. And so I think that's really confusing for the faithful. Because, and it isn't, you know, it's not only not spoken about, but it's also not presented in the beautiful way mm-hmm. that John Paul II showed us. The way that, you know, he just, like I was saying before, he just blew it up, you know, and talked about the love between a man and a woman and the gift of self and the, you know, giving each other, your bodies to each other and that type of thing, the whole theology of the body.
You point out that there are 4 points to on the role of the Christian family in the modern world. Bright spots and shadows for the family today, the plan of God for marriage in the family, the role of the Christian family in pastoral care of the family, stages, structures, agents, and situations. Choose at least one of them and reflect a little bit on it for us.
Okay, I'll choose just the bright spots and shadows for the family today. Actually, one of the things that I found was quite interesting is that people do want to be married. I mean, that was, to me, a very bright spot, is that in spite of everything, in spite of the divorce and all of that we have experienced over these many years, young people, for the most part, want to marry. So I think that's an incredible bright spot that they are willing, after all they've seen and the destruction, probably even in their own lives, that they would be willing to commit and willing to learn what marriage is. So I think that's an incredible bright spot. The shadows for the family today, again, they're just the culture. I'm overwhelmed, really, by this whole sexual, this gender confusion
yes.
of today, and how that's seeping in so much into our high schools. And, I mean, it's the number one thing in high schools is this confusion. And so that's really a dark spot. I mean, if you can't, you know, tell your son or daughter and get them to understand what it means to be a man or a woman, you really have to, where can you go back? How much further can you go back? I mean, families are dealing with this very issue that, no, God made you a boy. No, God made you a woman, a girl.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then, you know, having to take it apart, what does that mean? And why is, I mean, I'm sure I'm completely politically incorrect, but why the overwhelming homosexual agenda? I mean, why are families dealing with that today? They are. So it's very dark. I mean, I you know, my children are grown, although I have grandchildren, but I would be, and I am, for my nieces and nephews and grandchildren and everything, I worry for them. What do they, I mean, how can you protect children from the world today?
Probably the one I would have chosen as a priest is the pastoral care of the family. where you point out that it discusses the need for the church to become ever more involved in supporting the family in all stages of life, that the Christian family has a major role in bringing Christ to the world. And I remember so well when John Paul said that the future of the world and of the church passes through the family. That almost says it all.
Right.
If we can really it just brings it all together. The future of the world and the church passes through the family. Let's move on just so we can touch on a little bit of each of the eight documents. Chapter 5 is Life is Beautiful, and it's Pope John Paul, I keep saying John Paul. I remember meeting him one time. It was a wonderful experience. Saint Pope John Paul writes then on the dignity and vocation of women about, he speaks about the culture of death. What is he speaking about when he speaks about the culture of life and the culture of death?
The culture of death is, I had this explained to me a long time ago, but it is the idea that someone has to die to solve a problem. And this is really prevalent today, particularly with elderly people. You have this idea of when, you know, people are caring for their parents, and when will their parents die? When will we have to stop caring for them? When will, you know, it's a burden, that type of thing. And also the culture of death is just the idea of you're concerned with efficiency. You just want to get things done. You don't have time for people. You don't have time for family. We live in a very efficient world. And quite frankly, underneath all that is a death message.
And he wrote that one of the clearest expressions of how to build a new culture is we must promote a culture that defends and welcomes every human person. Quite a challenge. And you write that people are losing the ability to distinguish between good and evil in modern life. Far too many people in our culture, quote, value life only to the extent that it brings pleasure and well-being, close quote, while, quote, suffering seems to be like an unbearable setback, something from which one must be freed at all costs. And then the encyclical consists of four lengthy chapters addressing the age-old question, what is the meaning of life? And within that all-encompassing topics, the document speaks to some of the great mysteries of the human condition, including what is truth, what is happiness, what is the purpose of suffering? And the chapter's titles are The Voice of Your Brother's Blood Cries to Me from the Grounds, I Came That They May Have Life, You Shall Not Kill, and You Did It to Me. Select one of those for us and also reflect a little bit.
Hold on one second. I'm kind
sure.
of looking at the same page.
They start on pages 105?
Yes. I will take You Shall Not Kill. And particularly because I had an apostolate where I worked with women, and the issue of abortion was ever present. And John Paul too, I thought he did such a beautiful job, particularly with this. I'll take just this one aspect. And he, in Evangelium Vitae, number 99, and he talks to women, and he says, you know, that the decision, he says, I would like to say a special word to women who've had abortions. The church is aware of the many factors that may have influenced your decision. She doesn't doubt that it was a painful and shattering decision. But he says, try, you know, do not give in to discouragement and don't lose hope. Rather, try to understand what happened and face it honestly. And at the end, he says, you know, through your commitment to life, whether by accepting birth of other children or by welcoming and caring for those most in need of someone to be close to them, you will become promoters of a new way of looking at human life. So that is under that chapter, and I just felt that was such a tender way, because this encyclical, he's very, very I don't know, dogmatic, and maybe that's not the word, but he is very clear, very clear. You shall not kill. You shall not, you know, do this. You shall not do that. I mean, speaking very forcefully. And then he takes this turn, and he speaks to women so delicately, people who, women who've been in this position. It was profound, really, when I read it.
And I would may have selected that, too, but largely because of Pope Francis spoke that same way this week, didn't he?
Right.
When he spoke out against capital punishment.
Right, right.
And so it strengthens that particular teaching also. And reinforces it, doesn't it?
It does. It does. I mean, and it's. I feel like it's the correct thing to do. I mean, in this day and age, there's really no reason that you cannot protect society from a murder or something like that. You know, you can. I mean, you can protect. That's the whole idea of capital punishment, was to protect society. Well, you can easily protect society without killing another person.
Chapter 6 deals with the Gospel of Life by John Paul II. What is he attempting to teach through this particular encyclical? Where have all the women gone? Mulieris Dignitatem, on the dignity and vocation of women.
Yes. Well, John Paul II. He was actually the first pope ever to dedicate an entire document. It's an apostolic letter to the role of women in the world, and role of women, what is a woman, who are women today, that type of thing. And so it was quite profound, even from that aspect. But he always had a deep love for women, and you know, people say it traces back to the love he had for his mother, and then the love he has or had for the Blessed Mother, as his mother died, and he turned all that love to the Blessed Mother. But the reason that he wrote this document is he could see what women were doing to themselves, that women had lost their own identity. They were giving it away. They were playing into the culture. They were playing into the idea that they're there to be used, that they, and they were even, and still today, you know, are proud of the fact that, well, I use you too. You know, you don't only use me. I'm there too. I'm using you too. And he just was bemoaning the fact of what women have lost through all of that. Certainly women have gained a lot. John Paul II never argues that women can't work or they should not work. In fact, he, in his document Letter to Women, he encourages women to get out and work and change the culture. But that's the underpinning point of his document on women is change the culture. You have what is called a feminine genius. It's innate to you. Do not let the culture change you. Go out and change the culture. I almost hear him saying the world needs a mother. You know, be a mother. The world needs a mother. And it's been my experience. That's true.
And he was trying to answer the question, what is the mystery of woman? And he was determined, you write, to help women recover their dignity and to acknowledge their specific role in the society and the life of the church. That was his stated intention. And he held that there are few areas more misunderstood than the church's teaching on women, and that was in an age of secular feminism. So there was a great challenge there. Seven chapters, pick one of them to say a little bit about A Sign of the Times, Woman, the Mother of God, The Image of the Likeness of God, Jesus Christ, Motherhood, Virginity, Church, the Bride of Christ.
And you want me to say something about one of them?
One of them, right.
We'd
talk about all seven. We'd be here all night, though.
Exactly. I'll take Motherhood, Virginity. In this chapter, he speaks about the idea that Well, they were all called to motherhood, I guess, is, you know, biologically, just by the way that we are made, we are all called to motherhood. We may not, some of us may not become physical mothers, but we're all called, either even if we're are a physical mother or not, to spiritual motherhood. And that's what he's talking about, and that was what I was saying. He's saying almost the world needs a mother. The world needs these characteristics. And for, he speaks to women who have consecrated vocations, and he talks about you. The world needs you. The world needs your own feminine genius. Bring that into the world and to the people you interface with and that type of thing. It's just a beautiful, the first time I heard it, you know, coming from the perspective of a woman, I just fell in love with it. I just thought it was so beautiful. It was just like, and he says that, thank you, women. I guess he says that in Letter to Women, thank you, women, for being a woman, you know. But in this particular chapter, he takes the two vocations and then meshes them into one in the sense that we're all called to be mothers.
And, yes, saying that just as physical motherhood is a link with the Blessed Mother, so is virginity and celibacy for the sake of the kingdom. Mary, in whom motherhood was a total gift from God, is the prototype of the new creation because she is a sign of eschatological hope. And points out that it's clear the Catholic Church is expressed in these beautiful words, values the heart, mind, and soul of a woman. We're going to take our final break, and then we'll be back to speak with Terry Polakovic about her latest book, Life and Love, Opening Your Heart to God's Design. Welcome back to the final segment of Amplify. We end just about 5 minutes before the hour. Our guest is Terry Polakovic, talking about her book, Life and Love, Opening Your Heart to God's Design. We're going to talk, first of all, about the encyclical by Benedict XVI, God is Love, Deus Caritas Est. And she writes that it was written only 8 months after his election in 2005. And this letter was his attempt to introduce, in some cases, reintroduce the world to God with a human face, which is a face of crucified love. And when asked why he chose love as the theme of his first encyclical, he replied, "Today the word love is so tarnished, so spoiled, and so abused that one is almost afraid to pronounce it with one's lips. And yet it is a primordial word, expression of a primordial reality. We cannot simply abandon it. We must take it up again, purify it, and give back to its original splendor so that it might illuminate our life and lead it on the right path. This awesome awareness led me to choose love as the theme of my first encyclical." Tell us a little bit then about this, what strikes you most about this more recent encyclical.
Well, what strike me right off the top is that it was such a surprise to people that he would write about love. I mean, he went going into this position when he was elected Pope, he had many condescending names, you know, appointed at him that he would, you know, he was dictatorial and that type of thing. And so for him to come out with his first encyclical on love was a big surprise to people. And I do believe it fits in this book, but I am also personally taken by the fact that how he teaches us that love transcends. It transcends eros. It transcends friendship type of love. Real love is agape love. It's a love that we would, that puts another person first. We would die for another person to help that other person. And so Pope Benedict, which I think he just has such a gift of doing, he just elevates the conversation. I mean, and he does that in this encyclical perfectly.
And he points out that the love is possible, and we are able to practice it because we are created in the image of God, and that by its very nature, love must be shared with others as love grows through love. And let me go back. I had forgotten what he had said back in 1969, and when he was Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, and he gave a radio talk with a provocative title, "What Will the Future of the Church Look Like?" And he said then, "From the crisis of today, a new church of tomorrow will emerge, a church that has lost much. She will become small and will have to start afresh, more or less from the beginning. She will no longer be able to inhabit many of the edifices she built in prosperity. As the number of her adherents diminishes, so she will lose many of her social privileges. In contrast to an earlier age, she will be seen much more as a voluntary society, entered only by free decision. But in all this, the church will find her essence afresh and with full conviction in that which was always at her center, faith in the triune God, in Jesus Christ, the Son of God made man, in the presence of the Spirit, until the end of the world." And so many people look at these words as provocative as we look at the church today, don't they?
Yes, they do. Provocative and prophetic.
Prophetic, quite frankly, yes.
Because that's just exactly what's happening. But I can say that within the church, there's also a longing for this. There's a longing for a smaller church. There's a longing to shake off, you know, some of the, what does he say? He calls them the edifices. You know, shake off some of the signs of prosperity. Many people I think today are happy to lose the social privileges. They just want to be a community of love. And that's what the church was built on, is that people saw the community of love and they were attracted to that.
And the encyclical begins with a passage from the first letter of John, "God is love, and he who abides in love abides in God, and God abides in him." And you point out these opening words express the core of the Christian faith, and they tell us everything we need to know about God, for everything that God is and everything that God does is love. But you point out that today, love has become one of the most frequently used and misused words attached to the number of quite different meanings. And that brings us back almost to where we began this program, doesn't it?
Yes, yes.
But let's go in the time we have left to chapter 8, The Joy of Love, by Pope Francis, which is certainly closer to our time, when he writes, "Nor do I believe that the papal magisterium should be expected to offer a definitive or complete word on every question which affects the church and the world. It is not advisable for the Pope to take the place of local bishops in the discernment of every issue which arises in their territory. In this sense, I am conscious of the need to promote a sound decentralization that has happened in some ways, but perhaps not as far as some people thought it would."
That's true. And when I really actually first read that, it kind of didn't settle with me, because I like the idea, I'm used to the idea of the hierarchical church and the curia, yes, and the church in Rome. But, you know, in recent days with the scandals that are coming out, I feel that it'd be much better, and I think this is probably what he sees too, is to a decentralized church. I mean, not everything coming, because, I mean, the church should be at the level of the people and should understand the people. At the same time, I don't think that church doctrine should be changed between, you know, for instance, the people in Germany, divorce and remarry, can take communion or whatever that is. I don't believe in that. I believe that we are all one. But I think decentralization is a good thing. And I can see why he would want to do that. In fact, as seeing that as one of his first objectives. That being said, no, he hasn't done as much as he would have liked to, or he said he was going to.
Why is it that you believe Pope Francis is living Pope Leo's vision, where we began our discussion this evening?
see, you know, I mean, there's a lot of criticism of Pope Francis, and I think a lot of it is surrounded by, you know, is he bending too much? Is he, you know, is he going to change the church teaching? And I don't want him to change the church teaching. But at the same time, he's been handed, you know, a bag of, you know, problems, quite frankly. I mean, he's been, problems everywhere, you know. And so in that perspective, I mean, every pope that we went through in this book has also dealt with their own problems, but culturally, he's been handed Satan's society, quite frankly. He has been handed the society that Satan created. Mm-hmm. And now he's trying, I see Pope Francis trying to sort it out and trying to, you know, reach people. I mean, reach them where they are. He talks a lot about accompaniment, and I studied that a lot when I was, you know, writing this chapter. What does he mean by accompaniment? And he doesn't mean, and this is where the idea of communion and, you know, divorce to remarry, communion, that kind, you have to accompany people. I mean, he doesn't mean just like ask your neighbor to church. I mean, he means walk with them, help them resolve the situations that are holding them back from joining the church, or help them look at it. I mean, he does. It's not my anything that I think the Pope has said is that he says, you know, good for that, you know, divorced and remarried, communion, you know, good for you, good for you. I don't sense he says that at all, and I really want to make that point. He is not saying that, mm-hmm. But what he is saying is, walk with these people who have left. We've had so many people leave, and the young people in particular, walk with them. See what's on their mind. See what they don't understand. See where they have been hurt. See that type of thing. And so I feel that that is his answer to what Satan has created, quite frankly.
You point out that to understand Pope Francis, we first have to understand one of his favorite phrases, time is greater than space. And to date, this curious expression is found in all of his teaching documents. What does he mean by time is greater than space?
Well, what I interpret it to be is some things take time, quite frankly.
Yes.
Some things, it will take time for the issues to resolve themselves, or even the issues to present themselves. But even, you know, quite frankly, I have been reading some about the scandal, Cardinal McCarrick and the scandal.
Yes.
And everything. And immediately people are saying, we need to resolve it. We need a committee. We need to have a, you know, special prosecutor. We need to have this. We need to have that. And there's no thought. I mean, they just want an answer. They want to, that's how we're going to fix it. You know, we're not going to wait upon the Lord. We're not going to do this. This is what needs to be done. We're very efficient people. This is why we need to do it. You know, that type of thing. And I think this is what the Pope is saying, is that time is greater than space. We need to wait upon the Lord. Sometimes it takes time. We can't just fill the spaces with a special prosecutor, if you will.
And that's difficult, though, when civil authorities are pressing in upon you, and
it is.
You know, you need to act in some ways. But that's for another time. We'll talk about that another time. But there are 9 chapters in the book. You point out, in the light of the world, the experiences and challenges of families, looking to Jesus, the vocation of the family, love in marriage, love made fruitful, some pastoral perspectives toward a better education of children, accompanying, discerning, and integrating weakness, the spirituality of marriage and family. So let's just sort of talk about these 9 chapters kind of in an over way with the time that is left to us. We have about 10 minutes left.
Okay, so I guess I would like to... let's see. I'm sorry, Father. Hold
That's
on
okay.
One second.
No, no, you're allowed to just think.
Okay. Well, I guess what I can't find the chapter exactly. I guess it's Love Made Fruitful.
Okay.
And what I took from this is, you know, it starts, you know, chapter 5 focuses on love's fruitfulness, procreation, a topic that we've discussed. But it also means that love is fruitful. It's also out of our core family. Love, rather than just speaking of your nuclear family, your neighbors are your family, and your cousins and your friends and your coworkers, they're all part of the Christian family. And it should be, we should consider that when we're thinking of family and fruitfulness and building a community and that type of thing, that when my friend has a child who's hurting, I'm hurting. That I thought that was just beautiful, the way he put that in there, is that, you know, it is very important to keep the nuclear family together. That has to be first and foremost. But then that love has to be fruitful. It has to go out. It has to invite new people into the family. And, that's the way, to solve, you know, the problems, many of the problems of the world is to care for your neighbor, consider them your family, that type of thing.
And he talks, the chapter is about being light as the light of the world. He goes to the sacred scripture to point out that we should reflect on the family not as some abstract ideal, but as a practical reality, you write. And from the beginning of time, the family has been confronted with sin, which turned love into domination. And this sense has been replayed in every family, in every generation. And so when love becomes domination, it's not really a family, is it?
No, it's not. And that's what I, in chapter 2, I start that chapter with the idea that we, all of the problems of today can be found in the first 3 chapters of Genesis. That if you want to look at what is wrong with the world today, you go back to the first 3 chapters of Genesis. And, you know, not trusting God, and men and women turning against each other, that type of thing. It's all in that meditation there. But once we, this is where the original sin comes in, is that we turn. In fact, I learned once that men will dominate in a situation where women will manipulate in a situation. I mean, of course, neither are manifestations of love, but that's how original sin manifests itself in men differently in men and women.
And then you point out in that the root of many challenges that families now experience is rampant individualism. Why is that?
Oh, yes, that's really important. Because, and that kind of even goes back to the whole Industrial Revolution in that time. I mean, that's when it began, the whole idea of individualism. I mean, before it was farms and families and communities and that type of thing, but when people started going out on their own and getting a job for themselves and fulfilling themselves in this way and that way, that type of thing, it's a scourge on the family. I mean, where you aren't taking the whole, the situation of the whole, you will only do what you think is good for you. I mean, you hear it sometimes say, people will say, well, if mama's happy, everybody's happy. Well, that's not necessarily true, you know. I mean, people could be neglected and everything else, you know. But, as long as I'm happy, then everybody around me will be happy. Well, that's not true.
And now that we're at the end of this day, although you're 2 hours behind us, but here on the East, we're approaching 11 o'clock. In the part Love in Marriage, he says, my advice is never to let the day end without making peace in the family. And how am I going to make peace? By getting down on my knees? No. Just a small gesture, a little something, and harmony within your family will be restored. Just a little caress. No words are necessary. But do not let the day end without making peace in your family. Our first reaction when we are annoyed should be one of heartfelt blessing, asking God to bless, free, and heal that person. Our guest this evening has been Terry Polakovic. We're talking about her book, Life and Love, Opening Your Heart to God's Design. Terry, thank you so very much for being with us and helping to review these very important documents about the family, about life, and about love.
Thank you. Thank you again for inviting me. Okay. I appreciate it very much.
Bless to you and all of your family.
Thank you. You
all right.
Too, Father.
Good
Bye-bye.
Night. So we come to the end of another program. Let me just read in closing from a part of her book. When she writes, "We are a people of hope. We believe in tomorrow. And we know that our God is a merciful God." In fact, Pope Francis never tires of speaking about mercy of God. He reminds us that God is always waiting for us to come back and to start again. And then these words. Maybe someone among us here is thinking, "My sin is so great. I am as far from God as the younger son in the parable. My unbelief is like that of Thomas. I don't have the courage to go back, to believe that God can welcome me and that he is waiting for me, of all people. But God is indeed waiting for you. He asks of you the courage to go to him." And again, this is Pope Francis's words in the Church of Mercy. "How many times in my pastoral ministry have I heard it said, 'Father, I have many sins,' and I've always pleaded, 'Don't be afraid to go to him. He is waiting for you. He will take care of everything.' We hear many offers from the world around us, but let us take up God's offer instead. He is a caress of love." So we have to believe that we can live our life with love, and we can live the future with hope, because God is always closer to us than we can possibly understand. And that happens in the worst crises for the church, for our families, or for us as individuals. God will always be there. We need not pray to beg him. We just need to open our heart. Don't forget then how precious life is and how powerful love is. Tell someone now that you love him or her. Pray for peace as if it depended on you alone, and come back next Sunday and amplify with us.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Whatever happens today, take it on with a fresh cup of True Brew coffee. Now only $1 with True Rewards. True North Store's True Brew coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. As a free True Rewards member, pick the size that is perfect for you and pay only $1. Don't have the True Rewards mobile app? Find it in the Apple or Google Play Store to download and save instantly. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
You're jamming your favorite song, and while you aren't missing a beat, you could be missing a signal from your body. It's an SOS from your kidneys, and it doesn't sound like music at all. It's silent. High blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, and other risk factors can quietly stress the kidneys, leading to negative impacts on the heart. That's why you should ask your doctor about a simple urine test called UACR. Most miss the signal for hidden kidney disease and related heart risk. You shouldn't. Visit DetectTheSOS.com today to learn more.
Did you know your credit card points and miles can lose value to inflation? Credit card companies often reduce the redemption value of your points and miles. Now, imagine a credit card with rewards that can grow in value. With the Gemini credit card, you can earn Bitcoin or one of over 50 other cryptos instantly with no annual fee. Every swipe at the store or gas pump earns you instant rewards deposited straight to your account. Plus, sign up now for a $200 Bitcoin bonus to kickstart your rewards. Visit Gemini.com/card today. Check out the link in the description for more information on rates and fees. Again, if you're looking to invest in Bitcoin but don't know where to start, the Gemini credit card makes it easy.
The Gemini credit card is issued by WebBank. In order to qualify for the $200 crypto intro bonus, you must spend $3,000 in your first 90 days. Terms apply. Some exclusions apply to instant rewards in which rewards are deposited when the transaction posts. This content is not investment advice, and trading crypto involves risk. For more details on rates, fees, and other cost information, see rates and fees. The Gemini credit card may not be used to make gambling-related purchases.